And we're recording.
Yay.
Yay.
Welcome back to Smell You Later.
Your favorite podcast.
Period.
Period. The only one you listen to.
I'm Tynan, your co-host.
And I'm Sable, your other co-host.
We're so happy that you joined us again.
Yes.
I don't know about you, but I am experiencing a Valentine's Day hangover. But it's Valentine's Day all year round for me, so get That's into true. It.
I hope you all stocked up on discounted chocolates.
Hell yeah. And those Lady Gaga Chromatica Oreos.
Did you get them?
No, I still can't find them.
Where were they sold?
Not enough places. You know what, though? Marcy is sending them to me. So
yes.
It's fine.
I feel like that's the one downfall of New York City is that whenever there's like a limited edition anything, it's just sold out immediately.
Like, I don't even want them. I just want them. I just want to have them. They're so stupid.
You're just going to keep them and they're going to get really stale and crusty.
Like no one cares about them. Lady Gaga herself doesn't even care about them.
Sell them on eBay for like $600
totally.
In 5 years.
I mean, I'm not above it.
I would not be surprised if there was a buyer.
Totally.
Limited edition Oreos.
They're Oreos. They're never going to go bad.
Good point.
You know?
Okay. Our guest today was someone that we've been meaning to speak to for a very long time.
We've been trying to hunt him down.
Yeah. And we finally connected.
So excited.
Yeah. And low key, we just interviewed him to get on his good side so he can make us a perfume one day.
Very high key about that, actually.
Yes.
He is like one of the goats in fragrance right now. We all talk about Frank Vogel. Who?
But before we get to our guest, Tynan, what do you smell like today?
I smell so good today. You know, when you wear one of your favorite scents and it is always just as good as you remember it.
I am right there.
I'm wearing Hidden Fantasy by Britney Spears.
Special occasion.
Special occasion, because we're having the creator of the fragrance on the show today. And I like... No.
And you're wearing a Britney Spears t-shirt.
I'm wearing a Britney Spears t-shirt. Free Britney, all that. I have Curious tattooed on my arm, so I'm very down with Britney and her scents. So remember back in 2015 when I did that piece for ExoJane, reviewing every Britney Spears scent in existence at the time. When I did that, I called them all in from the firm handling the brand. They very generously sent me all of the scents. At the time, I believe that they were like... not 20, but very close.
That's
to
a lot. Yeah.
So I ran through them all one summer. I really like a ton of them. There are some that I don't care for, but Hidden Fantasy is like top two, maybe number one for me. It is so good. I mean, Britney Spears fragrances are often sort of what you would expect a celebrity fragrance to be. Not all of them. I mean, Curious is very good for the time. I really love Private Show. I think that's got a really cool perspective and a very fun storytelling element to the Britney Spears brand and herself. But Hidden Fantasy is fantastic. Whereas many of the Britney scents are very sweet. And I always say like, oh, but not cloying. A lot of these are cloying. Hidden Fantasy is so fantastic, and I knew it the second I smelled it. It is the warmest and spiciest of her fragrances, far and away. And the whole thing is centered around this clove note, which I think is, I mean, it's one of my favorite smells. You know, it's obviously super warm, super spicy, etc. And it just moves through the fragrance in a really, really exciting way. And it's definitely the hero of it. So the build of the scent, at the top, you have citrus, lemon, verbena, neroli. In the middle, you've got clove, lily, and jasmine. And at the bottom, you have a really nice warm base of vanilla, amber, wood, and sandalwood. And the clove just sings throughout the scent in a really engaging, stunning, beautiful way. I don't know. It is warm and sweet and fruity, but fruity in a sort of like red cherry way that it's not bright, it's not juicy, but it is sweet. I could talk about this. I've got to shut up. I could talk about this for all goddamn
day long. Isn't this one of her most popular ones?
So, no. So, first came Curious, then came Fantasy, then came Midnight Fantasy. Mm. And I think that's the one you're thinking of.
Okay.
It was the first Fantasy flanker, I believe. And that was the one that Chandler Burr, the former New York Times fragrance writer, famously gave 4 stars We're also having Chandler on the show very soon, Lord willing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask him about that. So that is probably what you're thinking of, but this is another flanker of fantasy, by far my favorite. And I'm very, very excited to have Rodrigo on the show today since he created it.
Yes.
I want to just pick his brain about everything. But before we do that, Sable, what do you smell like today?
I smell like Terry Mugler Alien. And this is one of the coolest perfume bottles I've ever seen. It just looks like a purple monolith. That it's like chic Star Trek.
Totally.
I mean, this has been around for a while. 2005.
Really?
I don't know. I would have thought it was like in the 90s.
I thought so as well.
Yeah. I don't know why something about it reads kind of 90s-ish to me. And like, this isn't my first foray with Alien. I remember... I probably had a bunch of flankers of this on my desk at Allure, but wearing it now and again, revisiting it, it smells like, I finally nailed it. It smells like the black sheep of a wealthy family where she was born into wealth, but she doesn't want to be with her stuffy, upper crust, boring, snobby family. And she breaks out on her own and probably dyes all her hair black and only wears leather and rides a motorcycle. Maybe she has a tattoo shop. And then she speaks like seven languages because she's gone to all the boarding schools. It is kind of feminine, conventionally speaking, but there's like a airiness to it that, I don't know, it's kind of light and airy and it just like kind of like soars on your skin. And it's not overly floral. It's not overly like any type of fragrance family to me, but there is a fresh sweetness to it that I think just smells very cool. Cool as interpreted by old rich people.
Yeah. That bottle is, I mean, I know it's all cool the bottle. Mugler bottles are, but it's gorgeous. I mean, it looks expensive.
It does look expensive. I don't know.
I know that these...
It's like kind of expensive.
Yeah, I know that these things are not cheap, but it's like department store high-end. But you could tell me this bottle is $3,000 and I wouldn't bat an eye.
Totally.
It's not, but...
It's funny how Fragrantica says, for like the notes, all it says is top notes, jasmine, middle notes, woodsy notes, base notes, amber, like that.
But
it.
Didn't Angel have literally like 30 notes?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
That's super weird.
Do you ever find that Fragrantica will give you more notes than the brand does?
I often wonder how accurate they are.
Yeah, also like, that.
I mean, even Sephora, just the keynotes are jasmine, sambac, cashmere on wood, ambergris, and it's billed as like a floral, woody, warm floral.
Yeah,
but it doesn't read floral to me.
Sephora's fragrance P pages are very tight.
That's fair. You know? Yeah. I mean, I feel like the jasmine and the cashmere kind of just create like a warm, fresh kind of vibe.
Totally.
But it's not overly sweet to me. It smells cool and rich.
All of the fragrance, all of the Mugler fragrance are just so fucking weird in the coolest way possible. Yeah. You know what I mean?
They're oddballs.
Totally. I mean, just from like the scents themselves to the bottles, I just like...
They're kind of like... eccentric wealthy people.
Totally.
They're like, they're definitely the person that you gravitate towards at a cocktail party where you don't know anybody.
I've said it before, people who wear like Angel and scents like this love to party.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, if you get involved with Alien, it's like suddenly you're like, why am I doing coke in a bathroom at 4 a.m.
Why have
and
I been
enjoying
up?
Every minute of it.
Why have I been up for 3 days? Yeah, like, totally. How did this happen?
How did I get on a plane to
One time I got drunk in Madison, woke up in Detroit.
What?
Anyway, Sable, who do you have on the show today?
Oh my gosh, our guest today.
Finally.
He is a VP master perfumer at Givaudan, one of the big time fragrance houses, Rodrigo Flores Roux. Hope I'm putting respect on your
so
name,
glad,
man.
I'm so glad you said that because I was not going to attempt it. I got as far as Rodrigo and skipped out the rest of it. All respect to Rodrigo.
He's just one name, just Rodrigo.
Like Beyonce.
In my heart, it's just Rodrigo. But this dude has probably, he's created over like, he's hundreds of scents, if not thousands. And
scents that like we all know.
Yeah, like tons that you all know.
Clinique Happy, John Barbados, one Britney Spears scent.
Mm-hmm. He did a couple commodity scents too.
Oh, right.
Juicy Couture, Hilary Duff, Hawthorne, who we also had on the show previously. Gap. He did Bronze Goddess for Estee Lauder. Isn't that one of your favorites?
No.
Who was talking about Bronze Goddess? He did a bunch of Elizabeth Arden. Ooh, Elizabeth Arden Green Tea. I like that one. Donna Karan, Black Cashmere, Dolce & Gabbana, a bunch of theirs.
People love Dolce & Gabbana scents, which is unfortunate.
Oh, he did Commodity Leather. That's one of my favorites.
Leather's really good.
Yes. So yeah, the dude's been around.
Yeah.
And he could probably walk down any street in Manhattan and like just smell people and be like, I made that.
Totally.
I made that. Yeah. So yeah, we have him on the show. We're going to pick his brain about what it's like to be a perfumer and about his career and all the other dirt that he can possibly give us.
Yes, we love dirt in this house. All right, welcome.
My name is Rodrigo Flores Ru. I am a senior perfumer and vice president of perfumery at Givaudan, the Swiss company, where I am based in the Givaudan offices in New York City. I've been living in New York for 25 years, but I am Mexican. And I've been working in the walls of Givaudan for 23 years. So it's been a while. Yeah. Like I said, I was born in Mexico City 50-something years ago. I grew up there. I studied biology in the National University of Mexico. And then I moved to France in 1989 to do a 2-year cursus diploma in perfumery at the International Superior Institute of Perfumery, Cosmetics, and Flavorings, which is in the city of Versailles, which is a school with an enormous reputation, and many, many, many of my colleagues are alumni from that school. I went back to Mexico in 1991 to start as a junior perfumer at International Flavors and Fragrances Mexico, where I honed a little bit my craft, and I worked in Mexico for 5 years. In the fifth year, actually, I was promoted and I was sent to work to the headquarters of IFF, which are here in New York City. That's why I moved to New York City. And I worked at IFF New York for 1.5 years. And after that 1.5 years, I joined a smaller perfume company that was Anglo-Dutch, but very like kind of edgy. It was a little bit like the enfant terrible of perfumery at that time, called Quest International. And I worked at Quest International New York on like almost 10 years. And by the 10th year, Givaudan purchased Quest International. And that's why I joined the perfumery department. So that's more or less like in a nutshell, my professional life with dates and what happened where.
Wow. Did you always want to be a perfumer? What got you into fragrance?
Because you said you studied biology, right? And then you
yes. So it's connected. It's connected very, very, very intimately. But you know, it's kind of the whole thing about my life is that you know, perfume has been a constant in my life. So let me tell you that when I was 12, I started collecting perfume bottles. And because I thought they were absolutely beautiful. So perfume was always there. But I started asking people all around, you know, my teachers or the mothers of my friends at school, if they could give me the empty bottles. And then I started being very interested. I was smelling them. And I used to, you know, play to smell them and recognize them, or ask my sister to grab a bottle over there and open it and put it underneath my nose and I'll tell you what it is. And then I started also, you know, as a teenager, being very curious and going to department stores and smelling things and asking for samples. I remember very important launches in Mexico. I remember the launch of Opium, for example. So by the age of 13, I really knew that I wanted to work in perfumery. I understood there was an industry behind that. My other grandfather, he was a very celebrated medical doctor. So he knew about essential oils and what they were and that kind of thing. And he knew people who worked in the industry. So little by little, I started, you know, understanding that these are their perfume suppliers, raw material suppliers, and how the thing worked. And my grandfather was a very active member in the French colony in Mexico. And he started asking around. And a gentleman who would import fine imported goods and some perfume brands, he told him about this school in France. So by the age of, I don't know, 17, 18, when you are already choosing more or less you're going to be studying liberal arts or numbers, or you're going to be a scientist, or you're going to be a lawyer or whatever, etc. I chose biology because the logical thing to do was to study chemistry, but I didn't really like chemistry. And I love plants. And actually, I love plants because of my interest in perfumery. So I chose to study in the National University of Mexico, the career of biology. So I joined the career of biology in Mexico, and I did not finish it because I started getting very anxious that I really, really wanted to take a big step and study perfumery. So I wrote to the school in Versailles, and I wrote a letter saying that I was interested in following blah, blah, blah. They had more information. I'm telling you, at that time, there was absolutely no internet. You know, the fax was going to be invented two or three years later, and so on. So it was also expensive phone calls or letters. So I wrote to the school, and so they wrote back to me, and they sent me an application form. And they said, this is a little bit uncommon, because normally we make our potential students come to the school, and you literally pass a test, some kind of math or chemistry, whatever, and also some olfactory things, you know, they would show you basil versus fennel versus aniseed or things like that. Right. But since you cannot come because you're in Mexico and you're 25-something miles away, so write an essay about why you want to become a perfumer. Okay. So in my French, that I thought at that time that my French was great, I wrote a little bit of a highfalutin essay about expressing the beauty of the tropics in Mexico. And I would talk about the crocodiles in the rivers and then the orchids that have yet to be discovered. Something really over the top that I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I really have to find it because when I think about it, it was really, really too over the top.
Right.
But anyway,
right.
I sent that application. And, you know, it was like that moment in the movies when, you know, the kid gets an envelope from the school and you open the school and then suddenly you get accepted. It was exactly like that. And it was like, dear Monsieur Flores, we received your application and we decided to accept you for the course starting September the 8th, 1989. So see you at 8 o'clock in the morning on that day. Bring a lab coat and a check of, I don't know, an enormous amount of money. And it was French francs, but it was just like very expensive.
Yeah.
And so that's it. I started studying perfumery in 1989. The courses at that time was for 2 years. And I graduated in 1991. And in a very interesting moment for the industry of perfumery, because during the winter years of 1991, every single student of the house of the school had to find an internship in a company, and it had to be like you yourself, you're left to your own devices. You write your letters, you go and do your interviews, you fight, because the young wannabe perfumers wanted to do a traineeship with the same celebrated famous perfumers whom you knew were like that. Perfumer to
the
to
impressive
train
ones,
with,
you know?
And so we all wrote to the same people. So we were 16 students writing to the same people. So I was very, very fortunate that, you know, I wrote to Givaudan at the time, Jean-Claude Elena, who later on became the in-house perfumer at Hermès. So he called the school asking for me and for another one of my classmates to go and interview with him. And eventually he chose me.
Wow.
So February, March, and April of 1991, I did an internship under Jean-Claude Elena at the offices of Givaudan Paris. Wow. So let's say that my first job in perfumery was an internship. So it was very interesting, like 20 years later, just like the apprentice of the wizard, etc. I went back to Givaudan, you know. So back in 2008, when the merger between Givaudan and Quest happened, it was full circle for me, because I did kind of a very big loop, went to Mexico, went back to New York, joined a quintessentially American perfume company, etc. Then I went through the Dutch and the English, and then I ended up in basically what is a French-Swiss company, which is where I started. So as I always tell my bosses, you know what? I'm here to stay.
Can't get rid of me
you
now.
Saw what was out there, and it was the first one
exactly.
For you.
Wow.
Do you remember the first fragrance you worked on?
The fragrance I worked on? Yes. This is not exactly G-rated, but I'm going to tell you the story because it's
perfect.
A great story. So I was very, 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 very new. I hired as a junior perfumer at IFF in Mexico. And, you know, kind of a very experienced but younger salesperson who is still a very good friend of mine. His name is Humberto Campos. He's a lawyer, funnily, but, you know, he just kind of ended up in sales in perfumery. Humberto comes to see me and he tells me, have you worked on the scent of a very popular Spanish shop that is very popular in Mexico? It's called Eno de Pravia. And it's kind of a lavendaceous, grooming, clean, geranium-y kind of smell. Hmm. So have you worked in that type? And then I said, well, no, but I more or less know how it's made. No, so, you know, it's not a very complicated thing to do, etc. So can you make me something that smells like that? But it has to cost. And then he gives me like no money. And it has to cost that because it's for a product that I would like really to bring home. That's the only thing he said to me. So I make them, you know, I make a nice little mixture. I remember, you know, a citrusy with tons of lavandin and lavender with a little bit of a powdery note and geranium and so on. I was a little bit overpriced, which had, by the way, has been the bane of my existence. The pricing of perfume. I do have to accept.
Ingredients are expensive, right?
Most of the ingredients, if you want to put good stuff, you know, good, like you know, remember that ad of Chivas Regal, the whiskey. It looks expensive. It is.
Yeah.
It smells expensive. It is, you know. Yeah. So anyway, so I made a concoction and off he goes, Humberto, and presents it to this particular client. And like a week later, he comes, you know, laughing and jumping. Say, I just sold your first fragrance.
And oh, my God.
I'm telling you, this is not a perfume. This is no haute couture French house, okay? Yeah. You know, so remember, you know, I started really not in the fine fragrance arena. And then I go, oh, my God. And you know, it's a nice, healthy little purchase order because it's going to be a product that is going to be very, very widely distributed in Mexico. And he said, and what is it? And he was just laughing and laughing and laughing. Like he was totally giggly about it. And like, okay, Humberto, you know, stop laughing and tell me. I want to know. Well, listen, it's going to be a new product. And one of the things about this new product is that it's going to be claiming that it has a nice, pretty good and pretty strong scent. And the product is going to be called Novo Hair Clean 2000. And I go, okay, that sounds, you know, a little bit technical and so on.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So, and what is it? Well, it is a medicated shampoo specifically designed against parasites of the pubic hair.
Oh my God.
For crabs.
You know what? If you're having that issue, you probably want that area to smell nice.
That's true.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, it's like, not that I know, but, you know, those medicated shampoos are harsh. Are quite harsh.
Yeah.
And so they made a nice base, which was creamy, looked like real shampoo, you know, with a little kind of green color and so on and so forth. So, you know, they kind of upgraded the product.
Yeah.
And so we sold Novo Hair Clean 2000. So that is the first perfume I sold in my life.
That's so funny.
And it is a product that you find in every single pharmacy in Mexico. So
wow.
It's just like, yeah.
Your claim to fame.
I'm extremely proud of it.
Yeah, you should be. What a unique story, too. What a unique first fragrance.
People is like, okay, here he goes, Rodrigo Flores. Never getting his head out of the gutter. Well, yes. I was made as a perfumer like that. And, you know, just kind of, you know, to curl the curl here, the second perfume I sold, the product is called the Shampoo of the Grateful Dog. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. These sound like jokes. They aren't. This is totally true.
That's so funny.
That's awesome.
I feel like so many people tend to overlook the fragrance of household products or like personal care products.
It is so important. It is incredibly important.
Absolutely.
You know, our industry touches the life of everybody 24/7.
Yes.
You know, it is one of the most important industries. You know, no wonder, and I say it with one thing, without one single gram of modesty, perfume, you know, manufacturing, we are considered essential workers.
Mm-hmm.
And people look at me with a funny face and people want to debate it. They say, no, I'm sorry. We are also extremely and very intimately involved in the hygiene of society.
Oh, yes.
That was, you know, kind of a big conversation before COVID hit. Now, during COVID, I think it's very important to remind everybody that not only perfume makes life people better, perfume makes people safer.
Mm.
And that is something that is very important. Perfume is, by definition, a safe product that is connected not only to beauty, but is connected also to well-being.
I think a lot of people downplayed the importance of their sense of smell until they lost it.
Also,
yeah, exactly.
Well, the sense of smell is the most, is all the sense, you know, even the simplest of animals have some kind of sense of smell, because, you know, what the sense of smell is basically is the capability of a living being to react to a chemical stimuli that is in its environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you smell it or you perceive it, you stay or you flee. And it is about, you know, something that is chemically active around you that will tell you this is a signal, of danger or this signal of pleasure or nurture or love or reproduction, etc. And that's what it is. You know, my father was a very celebrated scientist. He was a physicist, but he also had, you know, had a lot of points of view about the scientific philosophy and so on. And one day I remember I was telling him, oh my God, you know, my profession. That day I was clearly not a very joyful perfumer. You know, I was just like, you know, I'm not curing cancer. I'm not helping, you know, the hunger in the world. You know, it's like my job is so superfluous, making perfume, you know, for celebrities and this and that. So I was kind of, you know, punishing myself and chastising myself. And he just looked at me and said, you got it completely wrong, Rodrigo. You are absolutely an idiot saying exactly what you're saying, because the job of a perfumer, it is one of the most important jobs that there is in the world. And he says, and I put it there, you know, with people in the pharmaceutical company trying to find a drug to cure her, or even medical workers. And I said, you know, why do you say that? My father said very, very assertively, he said, because you work on making something that allows everybody to forget that we're going to die, because you cover the smell of decay.
Wow.
And it is true. That's what we do. We cover the smell of decay. There's very few things that are more essential than that.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to be reminded every day that there's an end and you're going to die.
Shit.
Nobody wants that. Nobody. No. And perfume helps in that.
Wow, that was powerful.
Yeah.
I think it's also people who take scent and fragrance seriously and the people who don't. I think the difference is people who cherish quality of life and think it's important and people who don't think about that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You know, when I say, oh, you know, you encounter this conversation so, so frequently. Oh, I don't wear any perfume. And I go, oh, poor you. And then, you know, that's another, you know, I say jokingly, but I am a firm believer that modesty is a very, very bad defect. And, you know, in school, a perfumer is like, oh, you know, the young perfumers have to be modest. You have to be modest. It's like, no, if you're proud of something, just flaunt it, you know. And so I'm proud of my craft. I'm proud of my job. I'm proud of the product I've been involved with. So it's like, it's this kind of thing. Oh, you know, perfume makes me sick. Poor you. Perfume makes me allergic. No, it doesn't. It's your brain. You know, you're allergic to your brain. Of course, I'm being a little bit, you know, cutthroat right now. Because yeah. I also have to defend the product I make. But sometimes it's like, no, I don't wear perfume. I have never. Like, oh, cologne. Cologne is not for me. Okay. So, you know, we have
but people still wear deodorant,
right?
Or like they, you know, they choose their toothpaste flavor. They choose
or shampoo.
Thank you.
Shampoo.
Yeah.
Like yeah. It does matter.
But imagine if I get into that conversation, then we cannot talk about politics. So, you know, I'd rather talk about politics.
I mean, you should be proud of your craft. You've like, how many perfumes have you made in your career? Fragrantica says like hundreds.
Yeah. You know, early last year, a friend of mine asked me that question, and she started bombarding me with little parts and pieces of Fragranticas and this and that and the other. So I did a tally, and you know, things that have been discontinued, that have limited editions, and that. But yeah, I have maybe around 350, 400 perfumes out there.
Holy moly. But
it's like my brother is a PhD in statistics, so he thinks very numerically, something that I don't do.
Yeah.
So, but he always says to me, how come you never get tired of innovation? And they say, well, listen, because that's what I do.
What a question.
A perfumer has to be curious, has to be driven. A perfumer has to listen. A perfumer has to entertain, you know. And, you know, I believe perfume is a conversation. So, you know, you have to keep the conversation alive.
Have you ever known if one of your scents that you've created was going to take off? Or were you ever surprised by ones that did?
There are surprises, the positive surprises. There have been quite many that, oh, I never thought that this was going to kind of suddenly kind of hit it like that. But on the other side, there's a little bit more of a disappointment of fragrances that you have enormous hopes for them, and for some reason don't hit it. And I say don't hit it numerically, because, you know, a big success can be measured under many, many, many scopes. But the most important is like, oh, it's like a, you know, top 10 best-selling perfumes in the United States, or of top 20 best-selling men's perfumes in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So that encompasses a lot. It encompasses, you know, a lot of the marketing stratagem. It encompasses the distribution. It encompasses if it's sold in three stores because it's a super selective product, or it's something that, you know, that reaches department stores and that reaches, you know, the travel retail arena, which is, you know, super important for a perfume to fly,
of course,
and so on. So definitely, you know, I do have a little bit of sadness and regret for more than a couple of perfumes that had everything there. And for some reason, you know, they didn't take off. But the industry of perfumery or perfume experts or bloggers, etc., you know, do recognize that kind of thing. That or Rodrigo's perfume, you know, he keeps the interest going, etc. I am told that I have style that people recognize them, and which I think is very flattering. But I want to think I'm dynamic as well, that I can do fresh very well, that I can do sweet very well, that I can do dark very well, and ricocheting and ping-ponging through a perfume that is very baroque and very complicated, and so it's something that is very brutalistic and very simple, or with a very, very kind of clear, you know, structure, etc. So I ricochet between the two of them, and that's the way to keep it going, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
Right. Do you have a favorite?
Well, have you asked a parent who is his favorite child?
Yes.
Who out of your 300 something children?
Yeah, exactly.
I do have to answer the question, you know, kind of, you know, tiptoeing around the swimming pool a little bit, but telling you that I do not show, forget about the client, I do not show the evaluators and the product managers within Givaudan, I do not show a perfume if I don't like it. And some perfumers do, and it's okay. So it's a question of self-indulgence on one side, but also of reassurance that I am going to deliver something that I consider beautiful, and I think I do have, you know, an aesthetic measure in order to say this is going to work, you know.
Right.
So have there been projects? Listen, not products, projects that have been absolute nightmares. Yes, but it's never the perfume. It's everything else, particularly people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a perfumer who makes perfume alone is wrong, is incorrect. Because a perfume is a common baby of many, many things and many circumstances and many moments and many people. So the perfumer could be considered possibly the first violin in an orchestra, a little bit like that. But you get directed, you need to listen to a lot of things, you need to be intuitive, you need to listen to your heart, etc. But again, you do not make perfume alone.
I'm curious, what is the process like from getting a brief and then up until the creation?
And how do you, like, as a perfumer, sort of interpret that brief and get it to the finish line in a way that you think fulfills the brief, but also in a way that you think fulfills, like, the potential of what the scent could be within
So let me describe you the process, and I'm gonna fill in the blanks bit, because the two questions are very related, but one of them is, like, let's say, to the outside, and the other one is to the inside.
Yeah.
So, you know, the way this works, and you said like a key phrase here is the famous brief. You know, it's like you're given a task, just for the sake of argument. This new incredible designer who was unknown just before the inauguration now has all the spotlight on top of him, et cetera, et cetera. And he was nabbed by a very important cosmetic manufacturer to sign a license, and they're going to launch a perfume in a year time, okay? I'm just inventing. I'm coming up with a story. But, you know, things like that happen all the time. And you read about the guy in the news because Mrs. Obama or Mrs. Biden wore the dress, you know?
Yeah.
And so you kind of know who this person is. Normally, you know, it's not a very known, it's not a household name, but it can get very interesting, blah, blah, blah. But this is a license, and then the licensee so goes to my company and another company and another company and another company that we work in the same capacity. So here's where it gets interesting, because the licensee would tell, okay, Rodrigo, so this is the guy, this is the brand, it's going to be a women's perfume. And the launch is going to be, you know, they always tell you a date. It's very, very rare that everything is on time. And then, you know, and then you get a brief, you get, you know, socioeconomics and, you know, targets, sweet spot for age and all the boring things. But also you get more juice information that, you know, this designer absolutely adores the smell of, let's say, honeysuckle. Mm-hmm. Or he absolutely loved when his father smoked a cigar, you know, things like that, you know.
Gotcha.
You get things like that. Or sometimes you also get, you know, we are really thinking the package is going to be white, gold, and pink.
Okay.
That's another thing. Very rarely, what happens, you know the name. Very rarely, what happens, you kind of know something more about the packaging or the bottle. In some cases, you get approached with the entire pack, with the entire thing, you know, and you have to sign papers of and tell that it is confidential, I won't say anything, etc. But right. That doesn't really happen because the moment they are developing the brands, they're also developing much of the marketing strategy and also, of course, you know, that the look, feel, bottles and packages and all of that. But sometimes you get that kind of information. In other, like, more well-known designers, in the case of, let's say, John Varvatos. So you know where John Varvatos, you know, where is his head? And you know what is his style? You know, right. You know where it is. Mm-hmm. But then, and then you get those pieces of information, and off you go. You go to the drawing board, and then I don't know. You know, maybe I was in the room with three other perfumers, and for the other perfumer, it resonated that the guy absolutely loves chewing gum. For the other guy, resonated that there's going to be a lot of golden details happening in the feel, the touch and feel of the product. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was really intrigued about the cigar story. You know,
yeah.
Because, you know, a perfume is also in the eye of the beholder and the nose of the beholder, if you will. Right. But anyway, and so I concoct a little, you know, tobacco idea, you know, just again, just for that. But my other colleague did something that for her was very golden smelling, you know, and right. The other one, you know, oh my God, I'm interested about, you know, like the playful part of chewing gum, and then it creates a chewing gum musk, you know.
So cool.
Then we go and we present these ideas to a product manager who knows how to smell and who also is in tone with the feeling inside of the development of the product, okay? So, and then that's where it starts, like, okay, you know, the golden, definitely not. It's a little bit too delicate. The designer is a little bit more assertive or is sexier, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. The chewing gum is fantastic, but we really need to tone down the sweetness. And the tobacco is a little masculine. We need to work on the... On the feminine side, okay? So that's more number one. I can tell you that in many cases, the modifications go to the hundreds and sometimes to the thousands.
Oh, my okay? God.
So this also equates to a big span of time. It is not uncommon that this development process takes 1 year or even more.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and that's part of the answer. But the other part of the answer is intuition. Mm-hmm. You know, why did I think about a cigar? Or how did I interpret the images of a mood board? You know, like the my other colleague was completely hooked on the thing that the designer uses a lot of lace, but I love that he uses metallic zippers, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So it is a very extremely personal thing. That's why, you know, I do like to say that diverse interpretations of a project are exactly what makes the projects interesting. And of course, we are put into competition against three other houses, like I said, do a very similar, if not the same kind of job that we do. It becomes, you know, is the tobacco going to be more interesting from this house? Or maybe they ask for a tobacco in the other house. That happens as well, with completely different interpretations of the idea, et cetera, et cetera. So you just have to be resilient. You have to be convinced about what you're doing. You have to have, yes, conviction, I think, is an important word here. And at the same time, you have to have imagination and have the craft in order to know where, you know, where to take the fragrance, etc., and you know where to hit the sweet spots. I always say that the most important part of the anatomy of a perfumer is absolutely not the nose; it's the ears, because a perfumer has to know how to listen.
Yeah. Wow. So you're competing with other fragrance houses.
Yes.
As you're creating
for a contract, exactly.
Wow.
Yes.
It's so stressful.
It is very stressful because also, you know, you can work on, like I said, 18 months on a perfume, and the perfume cannot see the market.
Oh,
you know,
God.
Cannot see the day.
Wait,
because
you have
the competition
to,
won. You know,
you have to create the. Wait, I'm sorry. Walk me through this. You create the perfume before
you win the contract.
Do you win the contract?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it will be those 12 months of torture, let's call it that way. And then at the end, you know that you're in finals, because we call it like that, against another company, XYZ, with a perfume that covers XYZ kind of necessities of the brief. You know that yours cover, you know, ABC necessities of the brief, because in many cases, the perfumes are quite opposite or quite different, etc. So, okay, you know, because they were really enamored with the idea of landscape of the other company, and they were very enamored with the idea of my grandfather's cigar. But, and then suddenly it's like, you know what, the designer decided, or we run a little market test, or there's many, many reasons why you win, and there's many, many reasons why you lose.
Wow. Wow.
So you don't get a contract, and that's it. You don't get paid. Yeah.
That's worse than the advertising industry. Well, oh my God. Yeah,
that's the way it is. It's a business model that is absolutely wacko, but that's the way
it is. Oh my goodness. I had no idea.
Is there any difference between creating a fragrance for like a typical fashion house, like we would think of, versus creating a fragrance for a celebrity?
Well, yes and no, because the limits and the styles get blurry. I would say that fashion perfume obeys to a specific aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Celebrity perfume and working for celebrities obeys to a little bit more of the whimsical nature of the personality. And some celebrities are extremely involved, like they smell every single nook and cranny you make. Yeah. Some other celebrities just let the licensee run with a story, and then they will receive four fragrances that are fully developed at the end, and then they choose one. That's when you get, it's very risky, because you're one of three, and you don't know even what celebrity is going to be in a good mood or in a bad mood that day. You know, it's like,
right.
You know, like I said, there's so many reasons of winning or losing. So when you have, you know, a style of work, et cetera, et cetera, I utilize all my methods to briefs that are for more economical perfume, for more of a mass market appeal, or to a very, 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 very high-end luxury brands, either, you know, jewelry, fashion, or even very niche brands that can give you a nice budget to work with.
That's so interesting that you mentioned in a brief that they will give you their target demographic, because I always wondered, especially with, you know, more mainstream kind of like designer commercial perfumes versus niche artisanal perfumes, that there always seems to be kind of like a common or like a similar scent profile to the mainstream ones. And then the
artisanal ones. That is also because, you know, let's not kid ourselves. You know, there's one innovative, important, relevant, like keystone fragrance every 10 years, you know?
Right.
Sure. And for many reasons, you overdose a raw material, or there's a completely new raw material that appears and is used as a signature and as a signal of that particular perfume. Or you revise a classic in such a way that it becomes new and surprising. I call that the Beatles effect. You know, you show a Beatles song to a 12-year-old, they will not know who they are, but they will say, man, these guys are good, you know? so that happens a lot, you know, as well. Yeah. So what happens is that then there's a big success and there's a lot of imitation.
Right.
That's do we read the future? And we would like to be future readers to see what will be the next type that is going to be like a big heavy hitter in 3 years. Yeah, a little bit. We have to think about it, you know, all the time.
Do you get to kind of be a little bit more creative or expressive when you work with niche artisanal brands?
Well, the answer is yes and no, because I want to think that in my particular, you know, working ethics, I want to be as creative as possible for every single project I have. Small or big, luxurious or not. What niche enables for you to come up with something that doesn't necessarily need to be commercial. And I don't want to say that every single niche perfume out there is completely wacko and uncommercial. I'm not saying that, but it's, you know, it's we call it UFOs, unidentified fragrant objects, you know? So it lends itself to maybe a higher budget. In many cases, that is what happens. You get a little bit more money, so you can put a little bit more of expensive stuff inside.
Yeah.
It's an exercise. In my own particular case, because I do have a quite nice presence of niche perfumery with different brands, or have become very good friends with a person who who owns a brand or who creates that brand, you know? So right. It becomes a dialogue that is part of your friendship. It becomes an interchange of ideas. Sometimes you have inspiration together. So in my own particular case, I have been very lucky and very privileged that my work for Niche is also emotional and is emotionally connected with friends and with people that they are your friends. Right. So it's that kind of thing. Friendships in perfumery are very important. They explore an emotion because perfume and emotion are so, so connected that it's just crazy not to mention
it. Totally, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I like that. I do too. How there's just more emotion built into the scent.
Not that the other big chunky, you know, big designer fragrances are devoid of emotion.
Right, of course.
Sure.
You know, they do have an emotional armor as well, you know, right? You know, and they have to, because they also remember that you have to touch the life of, you know, 20 million people.
You have to please a lot more people. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So it's a question of balancing it, but the emotion, you know, the emotional content of the product is very, very important to keep it alive. Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
You mentioned flankerization before, and I've always been curious how some scents will have like 25 flankers. And I was always curious what that was at. Like, why do brands do that?
Well, it's part of the industry.
Right.
And it's something that we have created together. Sometimes the flankers are better than the original. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes when the original perfume is great, so continuing the flankers continues on the greatness. But it's also the thing is that, unfortunately, the attention span of everybody in the past 10 years has become like that of a newborn baby. So we get bored very easily.
Sure.
So a flanker, a number two, etc., is kind of keeping the flame alive of something that, you know, you as a company put a lot, an enormous budget behind it. You know, one would wish that, you know, it could be, one would wish that the business model of maybe 20, 25 years ago of a very well-known brand launching a perfume by average every 6.5-7 years, because that was the rhythm of, let's say, Yves Saint Laurent or Dior. Let's a little bit basking in the sun of the success of perfume A, but still thinking about perfume B. You know, do we need less flankers? Yes, but at the same time, we need to maintain the companies alive, you know?
Right, so yeah.
It's neither a vicious or a virtuous circle. It's just, it's a different way.
It's the bread and butter,
It's bread and butter, and the same thing is that it's a different way of approaching how your company will keep on its relevance, you know?
Right, totally.
Right.
I remember reading somewhere about how designer houses like Yves Saint Laurent or Dior, that their fragrances are basically like what helps keep the company running.
Right.
Like, despite how fashion fluctuates.
Yes. Well, it's, you know, it that has always been, you know, in the articles of Cosmopolitan and Vogue that, you know, when you're a designer and you finally sign the contract of your perfume, that is when the big money happens.
Sure.
Let's say yes, historically, it's kind of a nice thing to say at the same time. But at the same time, think about, okay, let's you mentioned Yves Saint Laurent. Yves Saint Laurent came to the world as a designer that inherited the House of Dior because Christian Dior died of a heart attack suddenly. And Saint Laurent was working as a very young fellow, and his eponymous house was open in the mid-60s, if not before. The first Yves Saint Laurent perfume was the letter Y, Y, and that perfume, if I'm not mistaken, is 1969. So between the opening of the house and the first perfume, it's, you know, a little bit less than a decade. So that always makes me wonder, you know, people say that. And I always think about, you know, definitive cases of, particularly in French fashion, that, the perfume contract did not happen immediately. So there was a way of having a sustainable, fashion house without perfume.
Wow.
It's so crazy how the fragrance and perfume industry today has exploded so much. And I feel like people are thinking about scent way more in general in all of their products. And I'm wondering if at Givaudan, how are they thinking of innovating where scent is going in the future?
I think, you know, it's a very, very and I don't want you to seem that I'm drinking some kind of Kool-Aid. Not at all. But I do think that right now, and it was already kind of going, you know, the trajectory was going there as a very important vector into health and well-being. And after 2020, I think that is first and foremost, you know, to think about well-being and health and pleasure through health. I think that's very important. We are going, and I completely adhere to the points of views of, let's say, a Tom Ford, that he wrote the other day, I read in an article, that, you know, after a very complicated moment that mankind is living through, then what happened, you know, the First World War happened, and it was terrible, you know, the trenches and this and that, but then the Roaring Twenties happened. The industry will definitely readapt itself. It will kind of, you know, wear a different coat. Now, people are using the word pivot. So the industry is pivoting right now towards wellness. But at the same time, you know, the factors, the facets of luxury, pleasure, etc., are always going to be there. Mm-hmm. There is also, I think, an enormous call of environmental concern.
Yes, definitely.
Sustainability and all of those things. Again, I don't want to seem that I drink the Kool-Aid. I sincerely believe that. Givaudan was at the beginning of sustainability and giving back to the community, that kind of thing. It's over a decade old now for us. And we continue doing that. And everybody's doing it. And everybody's doing it in different scopes, in different aspects, mm-hmm. in different ways, in different styles. But it's a good thing that, you know, as perfume makers, the perfume companies, we know we have a responsibility. And we completely adhere to that, you know. Natural versus synthetic, safe versus unsafe. You know, those things are always in the mind. But right now in particular, it's not like, oh my God, I'm going to put a substance in the perfume that might be questionable. You know, that is what you're looking really, really with a microscope. Mm-hmm. But in the bigger picture, you know, the perfume is going to take a new personality, a new mold of an element of well-being. I am very convinced about that. And why not, you know? And remember, well-being is not only, you know, something that you're going to put in your hands and you're going to be clean and you're not going to have germs and viruses and bacteria in the hand. Well-being is also an emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and well-being absolutely. Is also, you know, an intellectual well-being, you know. So we have to look at all of those things. And like I said, and I repeat it insistently, the perfume companies are in the front, are in the tip of the arrow when it comes to those very important and very socially conscious matters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, was that not everything you wanted and more?
We could have kept going for hours, probably.
I mean,
I'm sure he could have too.
My favorite thing about that is that you could tell from the jump that he loves what he does.
I know.
You know what I mean? He's like super cool. Passionate.
And it's so interesting how he said the job of a perfumer is essential work.
Yeah.
And like is, what did he say? He was covering up the smell of decay.
Yeah.
It makes people forget about death.
They're going to die, right? I was like, you need to warn me.
That is some esoteric Japanese philosophy shit.
I was like, absolutely not ready for that. I was like, what kind of podcast has this turned into?
I think I just started to disassociate that. And I was like, what?
I know, for real.
Just thinking, like having an existential crisis. I'm like, what? But he's totally right. Fragrance, scent, it's life affirming.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you're doing is just adding this element of life affirmation to every product that you encounter. That's so cool.
Yeah.
I will never think of Windex the same again.
Well, and I love what he said, because I have the exact same like outlook on it when he was like, yeah, like people tell me that they don't wear fragrance, but it's like, but you do.
Oh,
you
know, yeah.
You just might not wear perfume.
Yeah.
It's
the
like
soap you use.
Every choice that we make, deodorant, with things that we interact with, yeah, or put on our bodies or our clothes or our sinks, you know, like that all has a scent, and you bought it because of it, most likely.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Your laundry detergent.
Right.
I mean, I know some people have scentless, but there's still a scent.
No, that was wild.
Yeah.
And there was also like so much more I wanted to ask him, but it was also just sort of hearing him talk about his experience like in school and in like in the labs and everything. Mm-hmm. I was just like, whatever you're about to say is so much more interesting than what I'm about to ask you. So I'm at peace with this.
Also, I feel like a lot of stuff I wanted to ask, he was like contractually not able to answer. So
I know.
Oh, well,
I know.
Secrets, you know, just the mysteries of the perfume world. Dun, dun, dun.
We're going to get someone sued one of these days.
You know what? I think if we just interview enough people in the fragrance industry, we'll just get like a 360 picture of
yeah, exactly.
What it's like.
If you can't tell us, yeah, someone else will. I love that.
That's insane though, that they have to create a scent to compete.
I had no idea.
That's
dude.
insane to
like,
me. What's
the, what is even the fucking point at that point? You spent a year on something with, like he said like thousands of revisions, right?
Yeah.
To not have it sell. Like what?
And then you don't get paid. That's...
And when you do get paid, how much is it that you can afford to work on something for a year?
Well, okay. I always have this like, just from working in beauty, I'm like, fragrance brands seem to have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I think it's probably a lot.
That's what we should.
I mean, enough them. That they're going to work on something for a year and it's going to be worth it. You know?
Yeah.
It's like a net 365. Imagine working on those terms.
I keep wiping off my brows. Sorry. God. I mean.
Mad respect for perfumers.
I just like. God, every time I think I'm beginning to know more about like the inside of how all this shit works, it's like, oh no, you don't know anything.
Well, that was our episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And, you know, if you're in our demo of Gen Zers, maybe this will convince you to go into a career of perfumery.
Yeah, do something fucking cool. Yeah. Thank God that we do, because it was like by the skin of my teeth that I got into a cool industry. Like,
same.
You can like, I don't know what I thought I was going to do when I was in high school, but it wasn't like this. And by this, I mean like beauty in general.
Same. Oh, absolutely.
You can do cool things.
Yeah. My life is not at all what I imagined to be like when, like 10, 20 years
ago. You can make perfume.
Make some perfume.
You can write about blush for 10 years. Yeah. Look at us. Fuck.
Like us. Write about blush for 10 years.
How did we get here?
I don't know.
Both in our lives and this conversation. Anyway, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming back every week. Feel free to follow us on Instagram at smellyoulater.mp3. I am Tynan Buck on Instagram.
And I'm Sabletooth Tikra.
It would be great if you could leave us 5 stars. I feel like such a ski saying that, but also it would be great if you could leave us 5 stars.
I mean, they're free. You don't pay for them.
It's like really easy.
Yeah. It's not coming out of your pocket.
And a review or whatever. So yeah.
Yeah.
Love you lots. Smell you later.
Smell you later.